Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. And I'll be interviewing island creatives to discover what they can share with us about the highs and lows, ups and downs, and possibilities of living and sustaining a creative life. I am really excited today. I have waited for this interview for a while, and I'm talking with one of my favorite island creatives, Bruce Morser, who's renowned on the island as an artist and an illustrator. This guy makes magic with pencils, magic you wouldn't believe, and he has been doing it for over 45 years. I'm really grateful that he's with me today because he's just done a reception for a magnificent exhibition at the Vashon Center for the Arts, a retrospective, which to me would be hugely intimidating to kind of see your art and your life laid out before you. It's a must-see on Vashon. It'll be up for the whole month of April, I believe. Is that right, Bruce?
That's right, up to April 27th.
Yeah, and it spans, you call it like six stages of your career?
Yeah, the title for it. It's one of those things like, quick, we got to go to press on this. What's the title? And what we came up with on a spur of the moment is 8,000 pencils, 45 years, six careers.
I love it. 8,000 pencils. You even have a little pencil display of pencil nubs, don't you, right there?
Yeah, this is, I reluctantly put that there thinking this will give people, maybe it's the correct impression of who I am, but I have actually saved most of the little teeny pencil stubs, and they're about, what do you think, a half an inch long?
Yeah, they're tiny. Like, yeah. I couldn't even steal them to use them.
It was funny to see if people were stealing them last night.
Taking one. Well, you kind of didn't know. You didn't know. See, is this like, you know, pick candy in the middle of the stage?
Yeah. I know. That was sweet to see.
Well, I'm talking in advance of a presentation, another must listen to on Vashon that's going to happen April 16th.
That's correct. Wednesday night, April 16th.
Wednesday night. Kind of unusual timing, but great for a lot of us. 7:30. And you can get your tickets at Vashon Center for the Arts, where you're going to be talking about creativity.
Yes.
One of my favorite topics. So I thought we would launch into it. I don't want to take the thunder out of what you're going to be doing that Wednesday.
Oh, don't worry. There's so many stories and so many things to talk about that I can't possibly spend it here too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll dance around this because it's one of my favorite topics, and I think you and I are on the same page with creativity being this term that some people think is only for the talented, and that's pure BS because we're all creative.
We're born
creative. Everybody has their own creative juice and their own unique way to express it. But sometimes along the way, we forget. So I wondered if we could just start by saying, what is creativity to you, and why, if this is our birthright, if it's baked into us, do we seem to forget?
Yeah, you're right about the baked in. We are literally, without getting science-based, we are wired to do it. Our biology is created in a way that basically encourages us to do it. We have two ways of viewing the world, and it's the combination of those two different ways that creates such a creativity impulse in us and allows us to see things in original ways, unique ways, that sort of thing. So yeah, we're just naturally born to be creative. So what is creativity? Yeah, that's an easy question. I guess it's the best anyone can say. It is this natural desire and joy that's arrived at from seeing the world in original ways, in ways that you haven't perceived it before. Often it's combining different things together that gives you a new pattern for how to perceive your world. Often it's just comparing one thing to another thing. Often it's exaggerating something or simply looking at something from a completely new angle. It's all these different ways. And I'll talk about each one of those things at this presentation I'm giving.
Yeah.
By the way, you said that was 7:30. I start talking at 7:30. But I would encourage people to come half hour, 45 minutes early to look at the artwork.
Oh, absolutely.
Because I will be referencing as part of my presentation. I'll reference some of the big pieces you can see there.
Good idea. And I'm just going to tell people, you know, some exhibits you can see in 10 minutes. You cannot see this exhibit in 10 minutes. I was there for an hour and I was exhausted.
Oh, that's nice to
no,
hear.
No, exhausted in the best possible way because Steve and I, my husband, said, we got to come back.
Because, oh, that's great.
And you even had little glasses there, which I didn't see until the end. So I could have gone and seen how you do these amazingly detailed illustrations. And I would have loved to see them up close, but that's a side point. Well, let's go back to creativity and what you're going to talk about there. So creativity doesn't necessarily mean that you make something with your hands or your pencil.
Right. That is one manifestation of it. You may leave a record of it, and it may be a physical artifact. It may be like a drawing, it's another kind of an artifact, or a piece of music, or my daughter's a dancer and teaches dance, and I know you know about dance, and that her things are very ephemeral. There's a series of motions, and then they're gone forever.
Right.
And like a song you sing into the air, it's there, and then it's gone. So it can be any of those things, but I think it's mostly centered around, for me, I can't speak for anyone else, but it is the sense of like, oh, here is something new. I'm somehow connecting things in a way that surprises me and delights me. And I think that's the creative expression. And I know I'm being creative when it either makes me laugh or it gives me this deep sense of joy.
So here's the deal. The creativity that you talk about is completely essential for the evolution of a culture. We need new ideas. We need new ways to put together things. Putting things together, we need to be able to see into the future and imagine it and then come out from there. And we need that heartfelt sense of play that's also part of the creative process to be able to just enjoy it, to have fun, to experiment, to play. So why do we lose that or lose touch with it?
Oh, I could end up sounding grumpy here, so I'll try
well,
not
and
to.
I think you know this, Bruce, because you have been you have taught drawing for many, many, many years, and probably some other things as well. So I think you have probably encountered the folks who have lost their belief in their own powers of being creative or being able to draw.
I think there are two ways that people lose the sense of creative. One is our society does things. Our education system, or at least the one I grew up in sort of going to grade school in the 60s and so on, and then college through the 70s, that it was not eager to try to expand the possible when it came to putting things together in this world. It seemed to be much more interested in what typically they talk about, critical thinking. I served on a college board for a decade and a half, and everything kept referring back to this critical thinking. My daughter went to a school, Skidmore College, that actually their motto was creative thought matters, which is really interesting because I'm not sure creativity and thought go together. But still, the school was very much trying to understand that, wait a minute, this critical thinking model doesn't necessarily have to be the only way we go. That let's be broader than that. And you can be a very successful, a strong organizer, a strong compeller of other people, and not all be critical based. You can do that with an ability to stay loose on things. I think my schooling experiences, they pushing hard to get as much information into people as possible, as quickly as possible, and that it was discouraged to just sit there and look at the fog, that was seen as non-productive time. And I think anyone who makes music, writes books, makes artwork would tell you there's absolutely crucial that you have to sit in the fog for a while.
Brilliant.
And be comfortable, not just veg out, but to really be comfortable in this sense of like, I don't need to know anything. I don't need to know anything right now. One of the things I talk a lot to my students about is this idea that if you're all about knowing this, knowing that, organize this, categorize that, get that all in line so that you can put it back maybe for a college exam. If you're all about knowing, there is precious little room for new. And I'm not saying that you want to live permanently in a non-knowing world, but the ability to go in and out of knowing, I think, is kind of the recipe for what creativity is.
That's so brilliant. That is so brilliant because I flash back. I'm a child of the 50s, and I was probably even, well, and I went to a really great school system, but look, I was expected to know. Yeah. I was rewarded for knowing. I was graded for knowing, and it was a certain kind of knowing. And so then when I got to art class, art was, you know, there was a little bit more, whatever, experimentation there. But then I was graded.
Yeah.
And early on, this is the truth, Bruce. I realized that I couldn't afford to get a B in art class if I wanted to go to Harvard.
Isn't that interesting?
And I was 10 years old.
Yeah.
And then in the end, I thought Harvard was not a good place for me to go. But to actually make the decision as a thoughtful 10-year-old that I couldn't make art because I'd gotten a B.
Yeah, that is discouraging to hear, but I think that's absolutely common. I don't think there's a lot of creativity in the SATs that you don't, that's not necessary. And I'm not saying that there should be. Funny kind of thing.
Well, take me back in your life, because as I understand it, you grew up in New England, right?
Yes.
And your father was an engineer.
He was.
And he was an engineer of a certain generation that probably wanted things done right. So how did it work for you? You were in a school system, you had a dad who was an engineer and wanted things just so, and yet you were a creative spirit. So how did you keep that going?
Oh, it was incredibly smooth, Sally. There were no hiccups. I do. It was a bumpy ride at times, and it was a fun ride. Fortunately, I was born into a very loving and supportive family, so that we had the typical roller coaster every family does, but we found our way through that, and it's true. But I would say that my father was an engineer. He was a naval architect and then an optical engineer. He worked on the coolest stuff on the planet. The Hubble Space Telescope mirror is his. The Keck telescope mirrors are his. The Pioneer lander on Mars, the first Martian, those kinds of like really neat projects. So he's a really strong engineer in a technical sense, but his projects were all visionary. I'm almost making a pun there. I don't mean to be, because they were such outwardly looking kinds of things. So at his heart, he also had a desire to be part of this greater sort of, let's do things we haven't done before, but he was doing it in an engineering way. Yeah. So he was kind of a mix of those two things. And I'm aware of that. I am a visual artist with a strong bent towards engineering things. There's actually a piece at the show at VCA right now. It's just a long table. It's about a 20-foot long table that is covered with imagery that I drew there. I made the table, then I drew all the imagery on it. It is specifically about this, the difference between father and son, that here is a hardball engineer, naval architect, who had an aesthetic, a sense to him, or a creative sense to him. And I'm a creative person and visual artist with a strong engineering bent. And those two people leaned on each other. There's a really good story around this table, which I'm not going to tell here, so that maybe someone will come to the presentation and hear the story, and other stories too. Let me back you up to one. You led with something I wanted. You said, what are those things that why are we not creative? Or why do we tend away from creativity, especially the older we get in school? I teach the fourth graders every year, and I see a level of creativity there that I then don't see with the college students I engaged in. Some of them become super creative at that point because they realize that's their path. Some aren't. But that's a cultural phenomenon. There is also a biological phenomenon that I think tends people away from creativity. And that is... And it's something you have to fight against if you want to enhance your creativity, that we, in order to survive in this world, I mean, it's even been boiled down. I've read lots of stuff about this, that It's kind of based on preserving energy, that if you're a human being making their way around this very, very dangerous world, that you have to do things that preserves your time and energy, your fuel sources inside, in order to get things done, like feed yourself and find a mate and all those kinds of things. And if you have to perceive everything all the time as this kind of original creative map, you're lost, you're hopeless. So the brain naturally creates all these shortcuts. So that, and we all adopt these shortcuts. It's part of, I mean, if you had to go out to the car and figure out how to start it and then how to drive it each time as a new creative experience, you wouldn't last long, and it would take all morning doing it. So we're built in with these creative shortcuts. They are biologically a path we all take for almost everything. So I often find that, yeah, I benefit from those. I make all these natural shortcuts that everybody else does. And I find myself, when I'm trying to get to the creative mode, becoming conscious of those and then trying to put those on hold and see past those and don't let myself take these natural good, they're good for us, shortcuts. You've taken my drawing class before, and that one of the things I tell all my students is that when I'm in the proper mode to make imagery, to make drawings, that I would not be able to drive a car. That even though I'm intensely visual at that point, I would be really dangerous driving a car operating machinery, because I am at that point, I've beat many of the shortcuts that would help me safely conduct a car or a machine tool, and I've put that on hold, and I'm now seeing everything that I normally can't see. So that opens up the path to creativity. I don't know if that makes sense.
Oh, it totally makes sense. It totally makes sense of that time when you have to suspend knowing so that you can actually see.
Yes.
And then spend time in the seeing, so it kind of opens up perception.
There can be new solutions.
New
things
solutions.
Things you don't know
and
that are equally true is the things that you really do know. But
yeah,
there are other things that are equally true, but they're not part of our shortcut pattern.
Yeah, and just to make it, you know, really plain, I know in your drawing classes, you would say to people, you know, don't draw an eye, don't draw a fish.
Yeah.
Because you will, you know, a lot of us came in, we thought we had to have a repertoire of, I can draw fishes, I can draw eyes because I learned how to do this. And then that blocks us from seeing the eye as it's presented in front of you, seeing the fish. So if we draw what we see as opposed to our concept, we can enter the world of drawing. Otherwise, we're just, I don't even know what you call it. This is Embracing the Muse, and I'm talking today with Bruce Morser, illustrator, artist, and all-around creative.
You know? It sounds so simple, too. And, I mean, here I am sort of getting towards the end of a career that's 50 years long, drawing images professionally, and I have to fight this every day. Every day I'm drawing, I'm struggling with the same thing. And I've been doing this for half a century.
Yeah, but let me, I'm trying to fathom how you do that, because, you know, if you said to somebody like me, who's an abstract artist, you know, just play and let yourself go and don't have any preconceptions, you know, and I can kind of throw paint around and it'll do whatever it does. It's one thing. But your drawings, you do both. You have mechanical drawings, you have drawings that are almost like engineering, and you have incredibly accurate, beautiful portraiture that you've done with a pencil. That requires a level of precision. So how do you combine that place of staying in the moment, open perception, with the need to eventually be precise with what you're doing?
The openness can also be very precise. That it is just an awareness of what is around you. There are things that are very sharp and very detailed, and there are things that are very plain, and they often come together. And just being able to see that, as opposed to the phenomena which happens to me and happens to everybody else, is like, well, wait a minute, I want to know what this is. You mentioned this, that I'm often telling people who are discouraged, oh, I tried to draw my dog and it looks terrible. And if somebody who isn't making their living at drawing or something just goes home and like, I'll just draw the dog, it's probably not going to go very well, because you are so cluttered up with your emotions around this and a preconception of what your dog is, or what any dog is, dogs in general, that you drag all this baggage in and you never actually see what's going on with your dog. And so it's almost harder to draw things you love, because you can't get away. It's harder to get away from those things. So that if you just, that's the trick. I have to turn that stuff off, and I consciously work really hard to become less conscious so that I can simply see what's there. And when I see what's there, I realize some of this stuff is very, very detailed. Some is very sharp. Some is very, and I've noticed the relationships between shapes and pieces very, very accurately, and I can draw those without emotion onto the surface. The thing I've always told the students that you're referring to is, say, don't draw subject matter. If you go into this thing drawing subject matter, you won't get what you want. But if you simply look at something and try to capture the pattern or the texture and just be truthful to that, let that totally infuse you and just stay with that. Don't worry about the subject. And then all of a sudden, the subject just shows up on its own. Mm-hmm. And that is so rewarding when that happens.
Wow. You have worked for some of the leading publications in the world. You've done a lot for National Geographic, and you've also worked with some of the leading corporations. How do you balance the desire to see, to stay open, to with client obligations?
Yes, that's a problem.
Well, you know, I think a lot. I have met illustrators, and I don't know if this happened to you, but they go through a period of wondering if they're still artists, because so much of their attention has had to go into building their business and representing something for the client, that they've lost a little bit of who they are.
Yeah, that is something, and I worried about that. We can get into this another time, but I also have a very hard time even now thinking of myself as an artist. That was like terminology that all of a sudden was a place I didn't want to be. I make imagery, and some people call me an artist. A lot of people call me an artist, and that whole thing is awkward for me, but that's fine. But
let me just do a sidebar, because sure. I think about that a lot, and as somebody who is a recovering non-artist, who defined herself as a non-artist, now it's almost an act of defiance to be able to say, I am an artist. Yeah. Doesn't mean I'm a good artist, great artist, or you want my art, but I am an artist. But I notice that people who are either illustrators, designers, or craftspeople are kind of, they're shy or shaky to use that term, because it's almost like the powers that be divided up the world between who the people are, who are the artists or the fine arts, whatever, and craftspeople are not artists. And I actually had a friend here, you probably know her, but I won't use her name, who does exquisite scrapbooking. Mm-hmm. And she didn't want to admit that she did scrapbooking because there's so many artists on Vashon. And her scrapbooks are gorgeous. They're very artful. They're beautiful. And that's the kind of ridiculousness that people sort of, they can't use that word.
Because it's part of the shortcut mechanism. It's like we need a shortcut to label these things so we kind of know where they are. And I know I get labeled an artist, and I'm totally fine with it. But it, to me, it's limiting. I'll give you an example.
It's limiting rather than you can't allow it to expand.
Yeah.
Oh.
Who's in the art club and who's not? You know, that kind of thing.
Okay. But isn't it sort of part of our power to take back the label? I am a creative, and if I choose to call myself an artist, I am an artist.
I think you just do it.
You just do it.
I people who know me well know this. I'm not big on, you know, terminology and so on. I tend to shy away from it. And in my whole life, I've just wanted to communicate to people with my best tools for that. I'm a talker, so I tell stories. I go to places like the Moth and that kind of thing and tell stories.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really fun. Scary at times. And I draw pictures and I make things, I fabricate things. And I do those because those are naturally comfortable places for me. I don't want to code and decode the law. I'm not good at that. So I stay away from that. But I can do these other things and they feel natural to me and they give me that exquisite feeling inside of like, oh, this is something new and original. I think this is creativity. And so I gravitate towards those and I don't worry about whether is this artistic or not. I simply don't even think about that. It never crosses my mind. It's outside of what I want to do. I had an experience once.
Which is wonderful. I want to underscore that for people. That approach is what opens up the world. You know, following what you're called to do, following what excites you, following where you feel most alive, and not worrying about the label or the is it.
I would see people. There are a few occasions, and this person would be dumbfounded. I think I've described this to you once very quickly, that this person had this impact on me, and had a huge impact on me. Assignment in college. We were all supposed to do a drawing. It was a drawing class. Do a drawing that impacted our classmates. So people tried different things, and people drew provocative things. Somebody drew something that was kind of pornographic. Somebody drew something that was kind of political and all this kind of stuff. And a lot of it was pretty terrible. And this one guy who had been a hockey player on the team who thought taking the drawing class would be a gut and a way to, and realized, whoa, this is not a gut. This is hard. But he hung in there, and he was not basically artistic by nature. Little did I know, he invited us down to the hockey rink. He was the guy who drove the Zamboni as one of his student jobs. He could make some money or pay off some of his loan.
A Zamboni is ice clear. It's what they use in hockey rings to clear the ice before the players go out.
Exactly. And there's a pattern you drive the Zamboni around. And so he pictured the big echoey ice rink, and we're positioned, our little group of maybe 20 students were positioned up in the bleachers behind the home net, and we're already sitting there, and it's cold, and there's a clunk as the doors to the boards open up, and another clunk as the Zamboni drives onto the ice, and this young guy drew a picture with the Zamboni.
Oh my gosh.
It so moves me. It moves me now. It's like, wow, it's incredible. It's like, that's what drawing can be. It's like, the drawing was nothing, but the power of the emotion of the fact that that could be drawing is one of the most creative things I've ever seen. It's so beautiful. It was so beautiful. It touches me now. It's like, wow, cool stuff. So that to me is, that's what creativity is about. Was his drawing an accomplished drawing? No. But he totally changed the way I look at the world. And he doesn't know that. I can't even think of his name now. And so I drew a picture on the side of McFeed's when McFeed's was about to be torn down.
Oh, it's brilliant.
And I took the biggest magic marker I could find and do it. And this guy, this hockey player, gave me permission to do that. His creativity was like an invitation to me, do something different than all these tight little drawings. So that's kind of how I see creativity go. And what is he an artist? He sure was helpful to me.
Yeah. Well, I like to be able, just again, as an act of defiance, to be able to open the term, who is an artist, but it really doesn't matter.
No,
it doesn't really matter, you know. And although one of the things about creativity, that one of the challenges is that it's like how to face the question, is this good? Or is this what I need to do without losing our playful, experimental, excited self.
Sally, that's the key question there. Is this good? And you've heard me say this, that when I have students or myself, I do this to myself, and then I share it with the students. I'll be drawing, and at some point, let's say I'm drawing a big, complicated portrait, and I'm going along in this portrait, and portraits don't look like the person at the start. You have to stay cool. You have to stay in the fog to let it actually end up looking like the person. So I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, and I realize the two worst things a visual artist can tell themselves, I'm sure everybody other kind of artist, but the two worst things I know a visual artist can tell themselves is if you're drawing away, to look at it and say, this isn't coming out very good. This isn't coming out for that judgment shows up. And then you're telling yourself, this is bad. The second worst thing, and it's only tiny, slightly better.
I can hear it coming.
The worst thing is, this is coming out good. Both of those statements, this is coming out terrible, this is coming out good, are so against the creative process. Both of those are terrible. You can feel the joy of the creativity without the judgment of whether it's good or bad. And so when I start feeling this desire to tell myself, Bruce, I think this one's coming out good, I step on that and crush it hard.
Yeah, good is such a loaded word and all.
It's terrible. Yeah. I stay in the feeling of joy. This delights me to be doing this. I stay there and I don't tell myself if it's bad or good. Those are simple judgments, mostly semantically based, and are very deadly.
Yeah, I totally get that. The challenge for me is how to move from play into craft and keep play. So that you keep learning, so that you're allowed to say, oh, I go to Bruce's exhibit and I'm inspired by the possibility of a pencil and how people can come through in a portrait, or how stuff can be illustrated in a way that brings it alive. And I want to do more of that.
Yeah.
And to be inspired and want to learn without some of those judgmental decisions that keep us blocked or sort of block the path in some way.
That, a lot of people have asked me about this. Or you mentioned the magic word craft.
Yeah.
And that when I'm in a creative mode and I'm being inspired by other people that are in this creative mode, there is this thing that lurks around their craft. So what you're making, how refined or how skilled or those sorts of things. And I tend to also disengage myself from that. I look at people will tell me, usually people tell me, you have way too much craft. Can you stop doing that? Can you do something creative?
They tell you that?
Oh, yeah. I've had, like, when I was at the UW getting a master's, Michael Spafford, the famous painter of the Northwest here.
Yeah.
We had a great relationship because he really despised what I did. And he really enjoyed our exchange because I held tough for what I was doing. And he held tough with his idea that you do not have to do all this stuff. All this craft you're doing is not helpful. I was like, no. It is my way. That is my natural way.
Wow.
If I'm not entering that place of creating new things that inspire me and seem to inspire others, then I will fish around for something else. But it's still working like that. And I happen to actually enjoy this magic of something appearing that is, and I like the refinement of a zillion little lines, and that's just appealing to me. Do I want somebody else to have to do that? No. I really like Michael Spafford's paintings. The 12 labors of Hercules or 10, whatever it was. I thought those are just awesome paintings. I really, really liked them. And they're about as low craft as you can get. And I just thought that was just magical. The other professor I got along there really well with was John Young, who was the guy who used to drive around on that giant old Plymouth with a big rock on the back, Plymouth Rock. And that he built things, big rocks with giant metal staples that held them together. It was kind of brutalist craft, low craft in terms of that. It actually was quite a bit of craftiness to do it, but it looked extremely low craft. And I loved that too. That motivated me very much. But I would respond to it with a sort of a precise kind of a craft. Most people would say, oh my goodness, you know, how do you stay sane while you're doing this? And yet that was my way. So I see them equally good. I don't judge somebody else's work as like, oh, you're not refined enough. That doesn't strike me interesting at all.
Yeah. No, that's so good. And I also go, oh man, did you have inner strength to be able to know what you love doing? And what was calling you?
It was a problem. Yeah, it was something that I had to find the limit of what I was willing to give up. And I tried other things too.
Yeah.
And I thought I can get the same sort of sense of like I'm in new territory here. That's interesting. And then when I would stray back to this craftsmanship or detail or whatever it is that inspires me, this relationship, I guess the best way to say it is a zillion little lines, that all of a sudden is kind of magical to me. Sort of like trying to look at like an ant colony, that the ant's movement individually is fantastic, but the fact that it's done this giant thing all together and they're all, you can't individually see any one piece, that to me is profound. And I think my drawings are like one of those big thatching ant hills where it's just you've got all these things going on all at the same time, and that together they say something. And I happen to like that experience, but I also like it when somebody else can do it with, you know, a Zamboni and a couple hundred feet of ice.
Yeah.
That to me is equally profound.
Yeah. I think part of the message for others who are interested in their creativity is this whole piece of being able to find your path, your way, what things in you, what brings you alive, and have the courage to follow that. You know, keep going. Because I think that's where a lot of people get cut off. They think, oh, it was supposed to be like this, but I love this, but it's supposed to be like that. Like my scrapbook friend, you know, Oh, that's not really art. But you love it. It's artful. It brings you alive.
I think the real trick is if you find your heartfelt place. I have more than one place that gives me that feeling. And I think you are 100% right, Sally, to go for that. Go for that. Don't worry about it. And that if you the thing is, sometimes you realize, well, this expression feels wonderful to me. It does whatever. And then I realize it interests very few other people. Mm-hmm. And that's the trick. Do I still want to do that, or do I have the need to interest other people in order to have that affirmation to make it worth it to me? I think that's a big challenge. And I would encourage people, no, go with your heart feelings, but then you can also try to find ways that collect other people if you need that. If you don't need that affirmation, then you don't need it.
Right.
And stay away from it.
Well, I'm starting a practice, and I'm going to share this just briefly because it's an acknowledgement of you in a certain way, and also our mutual friend, Annie Brule. Who turned me on to a person named Wendy McNaughton, who believes, like you do, that everybody can draw and that you learn to draw by drawing, you know, and get your pencil ready and do it for 10 minutes a day. So she had a program online where you do it for 30 days, and she gave some info, and it was hugely fun, and thousands of people probably did it. And I kind of got into the drill, you know, just the 10-minute day thing. And so I've been drawing, now it's 80 days I've done.
Wow.
And
great.
What happened, and I just noticed it this week, and we're probably day 70, was that suddenly I was just loving my 10 minutes of drawing. Mm. And it didn't matter how it came out or how it looked or whether it was good enough. Or whether I was a drawer or a sketcher. It was just, I could feel it evolving. Like, keep doing this, and something is happening, and you're enjoying it.
That's
and you're
spot.
Seeing the world a little differently as a result. And it's bringing you alive. And you can just let go of this whole mythology of I can't draw, I can't sketch, whatever, because it's irrelevant.
Well said.
It's irrelevant.
Well, that's perfect. That's absolutely ideal.
Yeah, it's so great. I want to ask you another question, and forgive me if it's personal, so we can cut it out if it is. But I asked a fellow creative who works in a different way and knows you very well a little bit about your creative past, and she admitted that you were dyslexic as a kid.
Oh, yeah. No, still I am, very much so. Yeah.
How did that, sometimes it's interesting because some of these things that look like handicaps are also great openings, that you're able to see the world in a different way because you have an issue over here, but it actually opens another kind of door. So,
dyslexia is like saying, I have a vehicle I use. You know, it's like, well, car, truck, bike. You know, it's like dyslexia is a big animal. So actually, there's quite a bit of experience medically based behind where I ended up for a good reason, which I can touch on maybe. But the dyslexia itself was a terrific gift for me. It was a huge gift to me because I had another gift that allowed that to happen, which is kind of really important. Something that I struggled mightily early in school with reading and writing. Had the world been a phonetic world then, which it wasn't when you and I were young, and I would have had fewer problems. The phonetic approach had been put aside for a look-see approach, which is terrible for dyslexics, and that made learning the traditional reading way very, very hard. Reading would have always been hard. Spelling would have been hard, but it made trying to get through those things nearly impossible. So a problem for me showed up, and this inability to learn the way everyone else in that classroom of that age was learning. And it showed up in a profound way. There's actually something at the exhibit that's worth looking at. There's this teeny little book I drew when I was in second grade for Mrs. Dickey, who was my teacher. And it sort of called to, it, it it laid bare so much what my struggles were with language that it kind of kicked into this whole thing. Now, the thing that was good that happened was my mother, who was just being a good mom, realized, wait a minute, this kid is got lots on the ball. Why all of a sudden is this massive failure in school where she was doing great at? And she looked into it and she took up a second career as a language consultant. And ended up becoming sort of one of the poster kids for language or for dyslexia in the New England area.
Wow.
She got involved in Children's Hospital there and worked professionally for decades on this subject. So I got saved. So all that said, I got through high school. Reading was always hard. I went to a known liberal arts college, and I got through it. I read almost nothing getting through it. I absorbed it in other ways. I found ways to deal with it. And so it worked out. I got through the things that normally dyslexia would cause a problem for. And that allowed me to toe along the things that dyslexia is magic for. So I see it as a profound gift. Mm-hmm. If someone came up to me, if the devil came up to me and said, I'm going to take your life and you have to pick all new cards and you only get to keep one card from your current life, which card would you keep? I would keep dyslexia as being the single best thing that happened to me because I had a lot of other deeply powerful things, a certain parent, that made it possible for that to happen. And dyslexia is magical. It allows me to see everything all at once. So that if you see the kinds of drawings I do of like, here's the Acropolis looking through it. Here's how a brain thinks. Here's how all those kinds of things that I do for National Geographic. Those are relatively easy for me to do. I can, because I don't have to see things in a linear way, I'm not tempted nor really able to code or decode things. I want to see everything visually in the relationships between everything all at once. And I'm simply wired to do that. So I can look at the whole space station and it takes me several weeks, but I can get it all in there, all in my head. And then I can move it around in my head and see it in different positions and swing it around and then understand what's the best way to understand how this works. I have a really easy time understanding big, complicated systems because of that. But writing a short paper about it is quite a challenge for me. That's what dyslexia does.
Well, that's incredible. That's incredible. And I already love your mom because, you know, I think the problem with is not the dyslexia, it's adding shame.
Oh,
and
yes.
Othering the child with dyslexia. And if you can take that away and just treat it as a gift that's going to require some workarounds.
Yeah, I'm seeing this. It's slowly changing now where everyone keeps saying, well, you had a learning disability. And it's like, full stop, breaks, everything. I'm not going there. I did not have a learning disability. I had a learning difference. And I learned differently than most of the kids in the classroom. Okay. And it was quite a difference. It was a different lane. It's like someone going through the life missing one of your major senses and so on. They're going to learn things differently. You have to channel them in differently. Same thing with me. It's really not that much different than that. And so when somebody says that's a disability, it's like, no. No, it's a profound difference. But what a bonus difference at times.
Yeah, what a bonus difference. When I learned that about you, I was also thinking about a friend of mine who was interested in his own spiritual growth and decided to stop reading for a year.
Yeah, how about that?
It was quite the experiment because in some ways, you know, I don't know that would be the path for everybody, but we're so barraged with written words.
Yeah.
And now that we're, you know, on the computer a lot, and they're like nonstop written words coming at us. And I wonder if we lose certain capacities that would be intrinsically others. Otherwise.
I think you can overload. I mean, we're at this broad range of abilities, and we can overload certain of our abilities. I think our minds are very, you can see this all the time. I've given you the example where if I'm sitting down to draw, I have to get into that state where I can't drive a car. This very, very, everything is equal. Everything looks equal. I don't know what I'm drawing. I don't, even though it might be a person or an object or something, I no longer think about that. I get into that spot. And that part of me that does that very well the awareness part of me is very happy to be there. The awareness part is also not a very good self-advocate. That knowing part of you, that storytelling part of you, is very much a self-advocate, and it does not like to be side-channeled. So it's looking for something to do. And that's that part you feel where you can't, you get into bed and you have to check out your phone. It's desperate. It's like, give me some, wait, I need something to do here. I want, before I go to bed, I'm going to activate this kind of thing. And that, so I'm sitting there trying to draw, and that part of my brain is just pestering me. And it always pesters me the exact same way. It always asks me, don't you want a piece of toast? It's over the years. And I've learned now, I get it a piece of toast. And then I can get back to my drawing. It is very much those two things. So I think if you lived a couple of months without reading, I think it would be a very interesting thing for everybody to do. You certainly wouldn't lose the ability to read, and you might open temporarily something that's like, oh, when I'm not reading, I'm also seeing other things I didn't see before. Someone like me who gets so much from not reading, I am also conscious of the fact that I need to keep reading.
Right.
That, because I could go away from reading totally and be happy. But I realized, no. There's a crucial world that I need to integrate with that is reading-based. So I go there intentionally.
Yeah. This is Embracing the Muse, and I'm talking today with Bruce Morser, illustrator, artist, and all-around creative. The thing for a lot of us who are so thinky reading based and all is I'll hear what happens to people when they go on camping trips, which hopefully they can do without their cell phones or keeping it off
less
most of
less,
the time,
yeah.
You know, less and less and all. Yeah. But you know, you've had the experience of going out on the road or camping or for you biking, and then all of a sudden everything comes back and you're fresh. You know, you're fresh. You sort of see with new eyes. Something settles in that opens up.
Yeah, it's you're easier to get that balance of not knowing in the world.
Yeah.
That reading part of you is this gathering of information, the knowing part, the storytelling part. And if you can just put it on hold for a second, there's a little fog there that you can rest in, and then something new will show up.
So I have a tough question for you because I don't have an answer for it. And this is the one that I'm struggling with because Einstein is purported to have said something like, problems can't be solved at the level at which they were created.
Huh.
Meaning that, you know, if we stay on the same playing field where we created the problems in politics or our life, we're going to be limited to the same set of solutions.
Yeah.
And we need a different set. We need to be able to see deeper or higher, however you want to see, to be able to imagine ways of looking at a situation. And I think artists do that in a certain way. You have to be able to imagine new ways of looking at the situation. So I'm trying to figure out how can we, as creatives and artists, whether you want to use that word or not, help this current situation where it feels so, I mean, the amount of distress, the amount of, I don't even know how to describe what I'm reading about every day in the paper, but and I look at how can we contribute?
I'm obviously affected by the same thing. I'm distressed about what's happening, and I sense myself scrambling around. What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? And what am I good at doing first? And then I realize, wait, I realize that's kind of, I get, the more I think that, the tighter I get into the knowing mode,
right,
as opposed to, I'm not going to change anything here. I've got to get out from this and start finding something that does add something, that is the higher plane that Einstein was talking about.
Right.
And I don't know what that is right now. I think everyone's just completely confused, and we're all doing that. But I know in my heart that what I need to do is, I have to spend a certain amount of time angsting. Everyone does. I think that's probably part of our chemistry. But then I get away from that, and I start intentionally get away from that, and I get back to this idea of, wait, don't know the answer. You don't need to know the answer. You just need to be present with all the things you've become aware of, and be present in that without having to worry about the answer yet, and then wait for something to happen. My creative process all through my life has been one of, I try to gather as much information as possible, but I don't do it consciously. I do it out of pure curiosity. I don't think I got to read up on this or I got to read up on this. I don't feel like I'm studying for Jeopardy or something like that. I just feel like it's whatever attracts me. And then at some point, not worrying about putting the pieces together, being with those pieces. And I very much feel like I can get so distracted right now thinking like, what do we do? What should we be doing? How can we be going down this road? That I think I just have to be with that creative process that I've developed over the years. And I'll see what my path comes from. Something will happen. I know historically I end up taking turns and doing things. So I will. Part of what I'm going to talk about on the 16th is exactly that. I will conclude on this thought. And that how do I feel right now about where we are? It's probably similar to what a lot of other people feel like. And what do I do with that? And some people are very versed at like, oh, we will have a rally. And I know I call this person, I'll call that person. We'll get that permit. We'll do this. We'll do that. We'll media this. And thank goodness they can do that because I don't think I can. But there's something that I can be doing because I've spoken through my art forms to lots and lots of people before. Hopefully there's something I can do, and I'm just going to wait and see what that is. It will come to me.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to hurry it, though.
Well, I have always loved the portrait that you did of Kay White.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I loved her, and to have her honored like that in the front of the Vashon Center for the Arts is just so moving.
Yeah. That was a case, too, right to your point of I didn't know Kay, and they asked me, the folks at VCA asked me, would you draw a picture of Kay for your elders show? And it's like, oh yeah, I'd love to get to meet her. And we spent the entire day together, and she walked my feet off around her property. and we had this, she's a delight. She's just absolute delight. You know, I miss her. And that she was not the person I thought she was. I was totally wrong about her. I just totally missed it. And to be present with her was one thing, but then to spend a whole bunch of time and like literally drawing, this is the beauty of, one of the beauties of drawing. I drew, in the end, you would say, that's the drawing of Kay, and over here appears to be the drawing of something else, like bushes or something like that. But that's not the way someone who draws a lot looks at it. It's like, I drew this pattern, this environment that involved a person and these background elements. And actually, I could feel her as much by drawing this dark piece of shrubbery behind her, which I spent a lot of time drawing. And all of that made me actually feel for her more. And when I'm drawing, I see very close. I see up tight. And then I see back immediately, huge, like wide angle. Then up close, then wide angle, wide up. And that way, the composition stays lively. And yet I can capture the patterns I want to capture at the same time. It's also why my eyes are still really good. And that feeling, it's not just drawing the person. It's drawing the entire environment that then gives forth to the feeling you have around the person in their environment. That's, I realize that begins to sound deep end, but that's quite interesting to me. That's where the heart and joy of it comes from.
Yeah, and that's where, for me, drawing, you know, it's not everybody's word, but drawing can be a spiritual activity because it connects you to some deep place. And,
and I love slow. It. That. The way I do it is slow.
I know. And
it doesn't have to be.
I have incredible patience, but even a quick willow stick drawing can express something. That's
I actually go to life drawing. Yeah. Well, I did before preparing for this show. And it's a once a week thing that, thank goodness, Mike McGrath puts on. He's a marvelous man. And so I stand there and I actually, you know, do a pose in 20 minutes, from a minute to 20 minutes, and it's so much faster than everything else I do in my drawing life. It's kind of wonderful to do.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. So I benefit from those experiences too.
Sweet. Is there anything I forgot to ask you about creativity?
Probably the simplest thing of all is creativity is like offered up mostly is this word. And I try to, in order for us to have a conversation about it, we have to use that word. But kind of like the word love or something like that, it just so diminishes what the actual experience is, that creativity is one of the two best things that I've encountered in the world. And I'll describe the relationship to the one I'm not naming and why they're together. And the thing about creativity is, how quickly can you sort of label what it is you're going to talk about or think about or feel about, and then immediately get rid of that label, such that I connect with that thing we've been talking about much better when there's not a word involved with it. And then it just is this feeling inside. And it mostly comes, I sense, when I'm being creative in my chest, not in my head.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, I can't wait for your presentation.
Oh, thank you. Good. Yeah.
And I will put in the show notes for Embracing the Muse how people can, you know, find out about it and get tickets at VCA.
This presentation will also have, I guess I can call this the world premiere of my, it's an 8-minute video version of a book I finished that I worked on for 25 years.
With your daughter.
With my daughter.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
It's done.
It is so
and
beautiful.
And there's a video version of it, kind of a, you know, Ken Burns style moving imagery.
Fantastic.
Animated thing. And that I will show that at the end of the presentation.
Oh, wonderful. How yummy. Yummy is that. And people can then go out into the exhibit and see, well, although they should go for early. And see, and they'll see some of the drawings from the book before they go in. So,
yes.
Anyway, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me here. This is really fun. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon, 101.9 FM, for hosting this show. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.